25 of Stick to Wrestling. We made it. Sean, we made it. How are you today?
Unbelievable.
You're doing unbelievable, or did I just present you with an unbelievable fact?
Both.
That's what I want to hear.
Doing well, and that is unbelievable. So you've been telling me all week that you forget, and actually you mentioned it on the Facebook page, which everyone should join if you're listening, because it's a good accompaniment to what we're doing here. And you had been mentioning that you forgot something from last week's
show. I did forget something. And before I get into that, I just want to say hello to everyone. Thank you for listening to the only Wicked Good podcast on Arcadian Vanguard Network, and we're the only one with absolutely no snark. Is that right, Sean?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't even like doing the intros. I'm just like, get right to the action. Let's go.
No, and I hope this doesn't become a regular feature on Stick to Wrestling, where the feature is things John forgot to talk about the week before. But I actually got asked a couple of times, why did they put the belt on Ronnie Garvin? Why him? And I'll tell you what I know, and then I'll tell you what the general speculation has always been. And I mean, the speculation, someone who was in the business kind of told me what happened while Garvin still had the belt. But Starrcade 86, and this is a fact, was originally going to be, the main event was going to be Ric Flair against Ronnie Garvin. And if Garvin won anyway, if the Horseman interfered, if there was blood, if there was a DQ, he was going to win the title. If Garvin lost, he was going to have to retire. And the second main event, which probably was going to draw even more interest than the actual main event, was going to be Magnum TA against Nikita Koloff in an I Quit Steel Cage match, a replication of what they did last year, the year before, with Magnum and Tully. And Magnum was going to win the United States title back, and they were going to have a house run with NWA champion Ric Flair. He was going to retain against Garvin, against U.S. champion Magnum TA. There would be a ref bump in the first match, and then Ronnie Garvin would referee the second match. Well, when Magnum got messed up in the car wreck, they completely changed Starrcade 86. Ronnie Garvin was on the undercard doing a job to Big Bubba Rogers, and he basically, I mean, he didn't get that big push he was going to get in early 87. Now, I can't say that Ronnie Garvin lost money, because you can't lose something you never had, but I think you know what I mean. I mean, those change of plans meant a huge amount of income lost to him. And Ronnie was well-liked and very respected amongst all the guys in the locker room. I mean, he got into it with Road Warrior Hawk and got the best of them. So I think what happened is, you know, they wanted to have the first Starrcade be Ric Flair regaining the title, and they said, you know what, let's do Ronnie the favor. We owe him one because of what happened last year. And, you know, despite everything, that is a big money spot, being in the main event of Starrcade. I'm sure Ronnie Garvin appreciated it the year before, when Ric Flair gets on TV with the brand new mink coat he bought from his Starrcade earnings and just started flaunting it on TV.
Well, two quick things. First is, we can excuse having to correct something to add something from last week, because we've decided to kind of continue on with the theme from last week, which... Yeah.
This show is going to be kind of the fallout of Starrcade 87.
Because you can kind of look at the Starrcade 87 as the beginning of the end. You know, it's kind of, you know, you didn't really know it at the time, but if you look back on it, that's when, you know, that's when it did not get better from there. So, but if that's the actual reasoning why Ron Garvin got, that's the dumbest thing I have ever heard. Really?
I mean, that is what I heard 31 years ago. And you know what? The other part of it is, I mean, if you can't get off the refrain of, well, we want to have a quickie with someone and then have Flair win the title back, I'm not sure if they actually had a better candidate, because all they had was poor candidates. Not that they had to do the thing where we have a quickie and Flair regains the title at Starrcade.
I don't even, again, I'm not going to go anti-Ronnie on this one, because, again, I still think this could have worked. You picked the wrong year for it, because 86, he was much hotter. He had a nice run in the summer of, Yeah, he was much hotter in that run when he had the little feud with Blanchard, right? This was right around that era.
That was the summer before. That started in spring of 86, and they took that around the horn at the Bashes.
Right. I'm saying that he was hotter back then. So 86 does make more sense to have him get the shot. But, I mean, why did they have to do it the way they did it? I just don't understand it. It made no sense. Why? Wouldn't you want to build up your champion as to, you know, to something going into this match? Nobody's going to drop the belt. Wouldn't Flair want to beat someone of significance on a guy who took 3 months off?
I totally agree with that. If they knew they were going to do this, they at least needed to put some belt. They only had about 300 to choose from on Ronnie Garvin. Like, they should have had the TV title on him or something. But, you know, I think that was not the road they had to go down. There were a million different things they could have done. Top of the list, I think, might have been Ric Flair as a babyface against Lex Luger.
Yeah, and I mean, I just, again, it could have worked with Ronnie. You could do Lex. Was Barry there yet?
Yeah, Barry arrived like October 86.
I mean, that's feasible.
The problem with Barry Windham is starting in January 87 and going through, I want to say April or May 87, he went around the horn with Ric Flair. So to put Barry Ric would have been problematic.
So who else did you have on the I like the idea of having Ric as a babyface, because that's what you're going for anyway. You want the guy to go over on Starrcade. You might as well have him go over as a baby face.
He pretty much did.
He did anyway. But I mean, that was by accident. But yeah, he did anyway. So who? So I agree with you on this. Who was there on the heel end of the spectrum at this point? You had, who was there that could have put? Yeah, you could have put up there on the heels.
Luger would have been the top guy, no questions asked. I don't think Arn or Tully was a Starrcade level opponent. They had Big Bubba Rogers hot in 86, but he had significantly cooled off by 87. They could have turned Dr. Death Steve Williams heel, but no, they weren't going to do that. That's really all I've got as far as
Tully,
unless I'm really forgetting someone.
Tully intrigues me.
Tully was great. I just don't see him being a Starrcade main event kind of guy.
I think Rick could elevate him to that, though.
Maybe.
I think
Luger would have been the best pick.
The Tully thing really doesn't. Yeah, but you think Lex was? I'm always gonna say Lex wasn't ready because I didn't like Lex. I think I'm sitting there picturing you flip Rick as a heel, because who's out of that whole lineup? Who is the most obnoxious heel there?
Oh, Tully.
Oh, without question. And you, Rick will sit there and Rick will make this. Okay, how about this? You have Tully. I give Tully like a quickie fluke run. Like a nothing, like a just an absolute, like a Mikey Whipwreck job. Like he happened to get a fluke win over Rick, and Rick's just like, I don't know. Tully's just act is finally just breaking Rick down. He turns babyface. Just by him being babyface, that'll send Tully even more over.
I mean, the problem though is, you know, you're competing with the WWF. They've got Hulk Hogan as champion, and now you've got the belt. And this was the problem with Ronnie Garvin, too. They had Ronnie Garvin as champion, but now you would have Tully Blanchard as your guy that you're combating Hogan with, and the guy's the size of a lawn ornament.
Yeah, but you're making the same. That's what they should have been focused on. You're chasing them. And this is what got them into trouble. You shouldn't be chasing them. Don't do what they're doing. Do it. What do you do that's different than what they do? That's what
you know what, I agree with that. But the reality is that, you know, fans make comparisons.
That's fine. And what you can be as, you know, they could be the bigger, badder guys, and you could be the quicker, more athletic, more, you know, I don't know, what they were in 1985. And when they went away from that and when they started trying to chase Vince and those guys is when they got themselves into trouble, because that's not what they were.
No, I agree with that. And once the promotion changed hands, and WCW tried to do what the WWF was doing, I mean, those were the biggest disasters ever.
See, now I'm more intrigued by. Okay, I had not given one thought of this Tully Blanchard thing until this. until we start talking. But I'm really intrigued by this, because especially considering it's automatically going to be a short run. You did Garvin no favors here.
As a matter of fact, Ronnie Garvin completely disappeared after this title run. Disappeared.
He completely disappeared before it.
Yeah, really. They did nothing with him for 6 or 7 months. He was like the backup guy for Jimmy Garvin in that ridiculous feud he had going with Kevin Sullivan. And then Garvin was, he was nothing until his heel turn. And as soon as his heel turn happened, he was gone like 3 or 4 weeks later.
Okay. One other thing about the Blanchard thing, because I'm obsessing now. Here's something. You also kind of have an idea of what the promos would be like, because you go back to 1984 when Wahoo had the feud against Rick. And who's the one who made that feud so interesting? Wahoo had a very logical way for flipping. That was one. Two was the obnoxiousness of Tully Blanchard.
Yeah, but I mean, Blanchard was absolutely great in his role. If he was if he was 3 or 4 inches taller, he wouldn't be Tully Blanchard. Part of his appeal was the fact that he was, smallish, that Baby Doll was a head taller than him. But, it's wrestling, size matters, and he was lacking in that department.
And you could add, Rick could add the size to the argument, to his frustration.
Yeah,
like, true. I should be beating you up. Why is this not happening? And it's just these bizarre, it can be. And now, you want your dusty finishes? Have your dusty finishes, your heart's content, because they all fit in the storyline.
And another positive, too, we both know the promos. It would have been a good feud. I just don't think they should have done Starrcade with it. But the promos would have been phenomenal, and the matches would have been phenomenal.
That would have been the greatest set of promos leading up to an event ever since, I would say, maybe like probably Rhodes Flair the year before, but I was sitting there thinking Rhodes and maybe Gary Hart leading up to Rhodes' turn.
Yeah, Gary Hart was not my favorite during this run, but anyway, another thing that was a fallout of Thanksgiving 1987. Finally, Jim Crockett gets full national clearance to have a pay-per-view throughout the country. Most of the cable companies carried it. Mine didn't, but that's okay. So what does Vince do? He puts on a free show on USA Network. Something called the Royal Rumble is born.
Now, the Royal Rumble was Pat Patterson's idea, right?
I believe it was, yes.
Okay. Was this, because I've never seen it, was this anything like the famous Battle Royals in San Francisco, or was that just a standard Battle Royal?
Those were all just standard Battle Royals, as far as I know. This was the first. Actually, I think they had a dry run at a house show with a Royal Rumble beforehand, but this was the first concept of the Royal Rumble where it's not, all 20 or 30 guys in the ring at once, where the guys come in during 2-minute intervals, which is actually it really livened it up.
It's brilliant. Yeah. I mean, the major problem with the Royal with the Battle Royal match is the fact that you have too much going on. So you can't get people to focus on what you want them to focus on. Here, that problem goes away in spades, because you could completely dictate. I mean, you've seen them do it with – you remember when they did it with Austin, when they had that little bit where it was just him keeping people out like 6-7 at a time?
Oh, yeah.
In a row? Yeah. So you're basically – and then you have little side angles on top of that. It's perfect. So basically you solved the two problems with the Battle Royal right there.
Solve another problem, because if there are 20 or 30 guys in the ring, you don't have room to do any spots. That's why the guys just like stay close and don't do much and just throw weak punches at each other.
And you have automatic face saving for your stars, because you can have them come in really early and go, wow, he survived a long time, like Gorilla always did.
Yeah,
always
exactly.
Reminded you how long the stars, you were forever being reminded how long Hogan was in one of these matches.
And to your point on this night, Bret Hart kind of escaped from that being just another tag team guy like Jim Brunzell or, you know, Dynamite Kid, he got elevated as the guy who lasted so long and did so well in the Royal Rumble. So they were starting to invest in him. This was really the beginning of his push that lasted, you know, for 12 years.
Who was his champion?
Who was champion at the 88 Royal Rumble?
No. I mean, who was Bret's champion backstage?
I do not know that. But he had already been there for like 3.5 years. He showed up fall 84, and he was doing nothing when he first showed up. And then they put him in the Hart Foundation, and that kind of got him rolling.
It just didn't seem like the guy they normally would push. That's why I was thinking he had to be somebody, whether it was Pat or, you know, whoever was backstage, kind of pushing this guy.
If I had to guess, I would guess it would be Patterson, because Patterson, even back then, I mean, Bret was an elite worker, and you wanted a guy like that. Plus, he was a good-looking guy, and you could see he was pushable, and they finally started getting him out of that tag team and into a singles role. I remember, you know, not getting off the post-Starcade thing. I mean, Bret got such a lucky break when he won the Intercontinental title in 91. He wasn't originally going to win it, but Curt Hennig, after the match had been announced, had to have, I don't know if he had to have back surgery or if he was just having back trouble and needed to take some time off.
Yeah, true, but he was definitely heading in the right. So what was the impact of this competition?
It's a good question, because I'm not sure how well the NWA pay-per-view show, once again from Long Island, January 1988, would have done anyway. And once again, the WWF, even though the Royal Rumble, like the first one, definitely had some dead spots, it was way better than Crockett's pay-per-view.
Oh, Long Island. Fantastic. You know, I made the case last. I'm going to make the case again that JCP did as much to damage themselves as Vince did.
Oh, totally.
By repeatedly, there was no reason they had to end up selling out. Okay, this wasn't a great Vince victory. It was them. They had their shot. They were there. They could have done something, and they repeatedly shot themselves in the foot. They went away from what they did well.
They did, and I think another part of it was, and you know what, you brought this up, we can talk about this now. In March or April of 1987, they purchased Bill Watts' wrestling company, the UWF. And they purchased it for the primary reason they wanted it was to purchase the syndicated networks that Watts had. The talent was an afterthought for the most part. And it was just so ironic that by this point, JCP had been on WTBS for 2 years, almost exactly 2 years. Yeah. And the talent was starting to get stale, and they needed an influx of new talent, and they had it right at their disposal, and they buried the new talent. And that was a huge mistake.
Now, there was one thing in our conversation we had leading up to the show that I brought up. So I just want to say this right now. Vince would have done the same thing. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake about it. He would have buried every last one of them. Okay, so I'm not going to sit there and say JCP was ridiculous and Vince would have handled. No, Vince would have done the exact same thing. With that said, how many markets do you think had the Saturday Night Show, the 605 show, and had Mid-South?
Mid-South was about at 90%, and if you had cable, you had TBS, but not everyone had cable.
Well, fair enough, but it's fair to say that a significant amount of the fan base would have been able to see both shows.
I think that's fair to say, and if you have one show that you have to pay, I think it was $14.95 show for, which is probably about $40 today, or you could see the WWF show for free with the Hogan Andre sighting, with this Royal Rumble thing that you didn't know what it was, but you wanted to find it out. And they also had a Rick Rude Ricky Steamboat match. You're getting that for free versus paying for Flair versus Nikita and Dusty versus Bobby Eaton. I think that's a pretty easy choice.
Well, JCP thought that too when they tried to initiate the Clash of the Champions. It didn't work out so well.
Whoa, wait a minute. Clash of the Champions was a sensational success.
How much did it affect the WrestleMania, do you think?
I mean, Meltzer reported it. It was a body blow to WrestleMania. They definitely cost Vince money. But more than that, by having the Clash of the Champions, they kind of saved the company. And let me explain what I mean. Supposedly, you know, they have this thing on free TV. And once again, you know, do you want to pay WrestleMania? I think it was $29.95. So now you're looking at about $80 of, you know, it would cost about $80 in today's money. And, you know, if you can watch Flair versus Sting and whatever else they had, Luger and Wyndham won the tag team titles. Dusty was on the show. You can watch that for free. I mean, a lot of people took him up on it because at the end of that day, Ric Flair versus Sting was the most watched wrestling match in history.
See, me sounding like an idiot gets you to tell a good story. So everybody wins.
You know what? Can I go way off the topic? Because I just thought of this when we were talking about it. Good story, I think it is. And right after Ronnie Garvin quit, I see Dusty Rhodes at the hotel. And my friend says to me, I'm like, oh, I'm getting my picture taken with Dusty. Here's my camera. And he's like, you're never getting your picture taken with Dusty. Which, of course, meant I'm getting my picture taken with Dusty. So I walk up to Dusty. I'm like, excuse me, Mr. Rhodes. Hi, my name is John McAdam, and I came all the way from New Hampshire to see you. You're my favorite wrestler, and I love that you're a Celtics fan. And I'm glad you beat up Ronnie Garvin in that hotel lobby and ran him off. Can I get my picture with you really quick? And, of course, he says yes. And, of course, I don't even look at the camera. I look at my friend with this giant smirk on my face. And that's the picture. And that will be posted on the Stick to Wrestling Facebook page. Picture didn't come out great, but it's there. It's easy to find. If you like the podcast, go to our Stick to Wrestling Facebook page and check it out. It's a good time.
$1 million smile.
That's what we got. But anyway, more so, the Clash of the Champions was presented, or Ted Turner saw it, as something that they could do on a regular basis, which they started to do. And, you know, Ted's in the TV industry, and when JCP finally circles down the drain, as they eventually did, one reason that Ted Turner wanted it was so that he could have, you know, every couple of months have a Clash of the Champions special that would do great ratings like this one did.
And the Clash of the Champions was, because you never had a card of that quality on TV, on free TV back then.
Some of the Saturday night's main events may have come close, but I'm going to agree with you. I cannot think of, except for World Class, like broadcasting the Parade of Champions shows. But then again, that wasn't live.
Right. And with it, as far as the Saturday night shows go, they were really fun. You would have one or two, maybe three good matches, and they always made their enhancement talent strong. Okay. So plus all the other shows, for the most part, outside of like Mid-South, the shows we got up north until Mid-South were all nothing. Like the standard New York show, WWF show, was terrible in retrospect. There was nothing on it. It was all one squash after another. So Saturday night was a revelation.
Yeah, I remember the first time, I didn't know what matches were going to be on that until, I turned it on. This was, May 1985. I'm like, wait a minute, they're having Hulk Hogan defend the title against, it was someone good. Who was it? Nikolai Volkov, maybe?
I think it was Volkov, yeah. On the Saturday Night Main Event, yeah.
You know what? The first match was Volkov, Sheik, and George Steele in the six-man against Steamboat, Rotunda, and Wyndham. Maybe it was Orton?
Actually, yeah. No, because it wasn't like a top guy, but it was a very good guy.
Okay, sounds right.
I'm sure we'll be very quickly corrected if we're wrong on our Facebook page. But
whatever, we had a big Hulk Hogan match. That was the whole thing.
Well, having Hulk at all. So when you ever saw the Saturday, the 605 show, that even that was much, much better than you ever saw before. The Clash of the Champions show was even better because basically all the matches were good.
They were all good. You know, and to share a story, I mean, I had a great big WrestleMania slash Clash of the Champions party, and on one room I was taping the Clash, and the other room we had WrestleMania, and everyone was like dead at the end of that incredibly boring 4-hour snooze fest that they had at WrestleMania. Everything in that tournament was so damn predictable. It was painful. And finally, you know, we get the Clash of the Champions tape, and as soon as Jimmy Garvin like wrapped that coat hanger around Kevin Sullivan's neck, the place popped, and everyone was alive again for the next two and a half hours. And one other quick thing too, when they started this Flair Sting feud, it was just someone to toss out there against Ric Flair. Sting was a nobody. And by the time that Clash of the Champions special had ended, I mean, Sting was going to be a made man at the end of that. And he remained a huge name for the next, you know, 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, that match for him was like the Barry Rat match with Rick on Saturday night when he went the hour.
Yeah, and that was one of the best matches of all time.
So
which,
awesome.
And by the way, it does tie into post-Starrcade because Barry got what Magnum would have gotten had Magnum not been injured, that early 1987 house run show against Flair.
My favorite, after that match, I don't want to say my favorite part of the match, but a fun part of that match afterwards was Dusty was legitimately shocked about how good that match was. You could tell in his face. He just stopped. There was a pause. He goes, "That was a hell of a match, wasn't it?"
My favorite part of the match was at the end when they needed Barry to do an interview, but somehow the microphone got stuck. So he's like crawling underneath the ropes trying to talk into this microphone that they can't move. That match is on WWE Network, and it's not just one of the best matches of like 1987. It is flawless. It is one of the best matches of all time.
It's one of those matches I always say you want to achieve that suspension of belief. Like, you know what wrestling is, but you want that one moment where you're just sitting there like, okay, I'm into this now, you know? And that was one of those matches where you just kind of forgot for a second. That was, yeah. I remember seeing that in the Ric Flair collection.
Yeah, it was flawless. It was 5 stars plus. We talked about the star rating system a while ago, but anyway.
Yep.
So yeah, now we have a bizarre situation where these guys are trying to make money doing pay-per-views, and they are now sabotaging each other's pay-per-views by putting on live events on free television so that you can choose whether to spend money or not. And this went on for about another, I want to say, year and a half. Not every pay-per-view, but it happened until the cable company stepped in and said, look, guys, you know, you're costing us money. Knock it off. And both sides.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really, that's funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah, they. And another thing too. I mean, we talked about. If we didn't mention this week, if we mentioned this already last week, I apologize. But Vince, when Vince created the Survivor Series in '87, he told all the cable companies, "Look, you know, you can choose this or you can choose Starrcade. But if you choose Starrcade, you're not getting WrestleMania." And that kind of, well, we need WrestleMania.
Okay, so I basically jumped ahead a little bit by accident, but so we're kind of, so we finish up 87, we finish up 87, now we're heading into 88, and how's JCP looking at the start of 88?
Things are looking bleak. I mean, they were counting on that Starrcade money to pay what was known as balloon payments to their wrestlers and the way the contracts worked, I'm not an expert at this, but here's how I understand it. The wrestlers were promised a certain amount of money, and if they were short by the end of the year, Crockett would make it up in a balloon payment, and he was unable to make those balloon payments because he was counting on Starrcade and the pay-per-view money to make them, and now he had a bunch of his wrestlers, he was in default on their contracts, and which meant that, you know, if any of the wrestlers who, you know, if he had defaulted on their contract, they could be a free agent and go to the WWF, and a bunch of them did eventually.
Who started with the contracts? Because that's basically a new thing in wrestling at this point.
Yeah, it was. Let me see. I mean, Vince started with them in 84, and I think Crockett started doing contracts with the wrestlers in 1985. I know Watts started in 85 as well. And that's the thing, like in a competitive, you know, you're no longer in an industry where the promoters cooperate, you know, oh, I'm sorry, but you can't have Killer Khan until I finish him up, that sort of thing. And you needed those contracts to protect yourself. Well, but the exact thing that Crockett needed the contracts for, he no longer had.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And Dusty, at this point, is beginning to run out of ideas.
He is. I think every booker has a shelf life, and Dusty was running towards the end of his. And there was really a cry from a lot of people outside of the company, like, you know, people who read The Observer were like, look, you know, Dusty is done. He is out of ideas. And there are people within the company who kind of thought the same thing.
And in response, Dusty comes up with Dusty in a Mask.
The Midnight Rider, which was moderately successful in 1982 and 83 in Florida. Now, let's talk about this for a minute.
And in another version in the 70s as Uvalde Slim, which is basically the same thing.
Well, yeah, exactly. But here, picture this. I used to. But, like, you have that special bottle of wine that you're keeping for that really, really special occasion, or a bottle of champagne, something like that. You've got this tucked away, and you're not opening it until, like, you know, a once-in-a-decade or once-in-a-lifetime event. Magnum TA got messed up in a car accident. I shouldn't be that callous. That's the second time I said that. But he was injured, seriously injured in a car accident. And they had the angle, you know, do not break until emergency, where the heels attack a helpless Magnum TA. And they finally pulled the trigger on it. It was March 1988, where J.J. Dillon and Tully Blanchard come out and confront Magnum T.A., who is carrying a baseball bat as an equalizer. Well, J.J. Dillon grabs Magnum, holds his hands behind his back on TV, and Tully slugs him a couple of times. J.J., of course, gently as possible, puts Magnum on the ground. You could just see it on TV. It was hilarious. He had to do it, I know. And then Dusty comes out, grabs the baseball bat, and starts beating on Tully Blanchard with it. By the way, Dusty doesn't know how to beat up a guy with a baseball bat, apparently. And then Jim Crockett Jr. comes out to break it up, the first guy you'd want breaking up a fight, and Dusty inadvertently hits him with the bat. Oh, no. So the NWA – now, this is the thing that killed me. They had a meeting with the NWA Board of Governors. And the Board of Governors decided to suspend Dusty Rhodes for 120 days, starting right after the April 15th card in Boston, because Dusty liked wrestling at the Boston Garden. This is true. And they had the thing on TV where everyone's coming out of the boardroom, and it's like Paul Bosch, Peter Burkholz, Jim Crockett Jr., and they're all like disagreeing with this decision. Oh my God, how could they do this? Who is they? Everyone on the committee voted against it.
The NWA Board of Governors, that just must be a big Mardi Gras right there. That crew.
So anyway, Dusty, we talked about this last week. They did the Midnight Rider angle, and they turned NWA, all of their television, and by the way, they had an insane amount of television at this point. They had the WTBS show on Saturday. They had on Saturday at 6:05, but then they had a Saturday morning show. They also had a Sunday afternoon show. They had NWA Pro, NWA Worldwide, and whatever was left of the I think Florida was gone by this point. But whatever was left of what they had for Mid-South. So that's a lot of television.
There is no reason to run this angle. Why do you have to run out? This was 2 years later they had this angle, wasn't it?
The yes, Midnight Rider angle? I think at this point, Magnum was probably well enough to perform the angle. He was probably well enough to actually, you know, it was probably pretty recent that he was well enough to walk on his own.
But why does the angle involving Magnum have to involve the Midnight Rider? I mean, seriously, it's been two years. What is Jim Cornette, 7 years between angles? Does he roll this one out three times in 6 years?
Okay, my defense of Dusty is that the Florida angle was done locally. If you didn't live in Florida, you didn't see it.
Okay, I stand corrected. Twice in 3 years. That's much better. It's right there. Him bringing it up should have been like, you know, Dusty, we, you know, maybe we need some fresh blood in here. Was it ever considered?
Well, bringing in fresh blood? No. Dusty was happy with his crew on top. And like I said, I think after 2 years, that crew got very stale. Think about this. In 1985, everyone was brand new, so it was fine. 86, okay, you know, now we're getting to know these guys. We've established their characters, and they had a really hot 1986. Now it's 87, and, I mean, the Rock and Roll Express are no longer over like they were. Magnum TA is out of commission. And the only guy that they brought in that they gave a significant push to was Lex Luger.
And I still don't know why. I still don't know why they decided to bury all the UWF guys. Except for Steve Williams. I'm sorry.
And even Steve Williams. I mean, he was gone within a year. I mean, and the reason they pushed him. Number one, I mean, Watts was in the middle of giving Williams a giant push. So they figured they'd finish that one out. And I think they saw something in Doc, especially in that area, because he played for the University of Oklahoma.
Hey, wait, I have an idea for a main event for Starrcade 87, if you do okay. It right. Terry Taylor.
If you had given me some time to put that together, I am confident that I could have made that work. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, God, Terry Taylor. No. Hey, the guy
Terry
had
Taylor
a ton
was good
of talent.
Back then. Terry Taylor was good back then. He was great Mid-South.
Yeah, give me some time to put that together and give me the book 3 months in advance, and I will give you that main event. But, you know, I'm not Dusty, and Dusty did not like Terry. I'll tell you why I heard Dusty didn't like Terry. And there's two stories out there. One, which is kind of the new version out there. They were on an airplane, and Dusty had headphones on, and Terry Taylor started doing a Dusty impersonation, which Dusty could hear, and Dusty was offended. The second, the version I heard, like back in 88, 89, why Dusty didn't like Taylor, is that Terry Taylor was with JCP mid to end of 1985, and supposedly there was a meeting amongst the wrestlers that Dusty was chairing, and he said, you know, all right, look, you know, if anyone here is unhappy with your push, that's cool. Come see me and we'll work something out. And in front of everyone, Terry Taylor says, I want out. And Dusty, you know, if that is what happened, obviously Dusty, that put a bad taste in Dusty's mouth.
Okay, it cannot possibly be the first part of it, because if Dusty was going to hold a grudge against everyone who's done a Dusty impersonation, there'd be two people on the card, Dusty and his mama. And even his mama might be doing one. I don't know. So what bothers me about the Taylor thing is similar to, like, say, Tommy Rich. You have to come up with all these conspiracies. You know what the conspiracy is about Tommy Rich getting the title? He was over in 1984. Okay, this is not ECW Tommy Rich. This isn't even 1983 Tommy Rich. This is 1981 Tommy Rich, and he was over. Terry Taylor in 1985 and 1986 was damn good.
He was, and they put the national title on him, and they, you know, it looked like the start of a big push, and then Terry found out that he was losing the title to Buddy Landell, who was going to get a big push. I don't know if I've mentioned this on the show before, and on Starrcade 85 was supposed to be the beginning of big things for Buddy Landell. Baby Doll was going to leave Tully Blanchard for Buddy Landell because Buddy had a title and Tully didn't, and that's how they were originally going to put JJ and Tully together. But Buddy messed up, and that was the end of that.
So, okay, now, before the show, we usually send emails back and forth, kind of going over some ideas, and you have an idea here that I don't know about, and I'm very intrigued. It is the 1988 Jim Crockett Senior Memorial Cup. Now, just as a precursor, this is the second, correct?
It was the third Crockett Cup in the last one.
Okay, so this is the third Crockett Cup, and to be honest with you, it wasn't the worst idea in the world, but this tournament had the same problem that every tournament in the history of wrestling has, which is there are way too many matches.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, they think if there's 40 matches in the tournament, even though that's mathematically impossible, even if there's like 40, it makes it more important. No. How about we have like four or, like, you know, 8 good matches at the most? But again, you would have a million matches in these things that were all 3 minutes long. And it was a two-day, it was like two cards, one in the morning, one at night. Mm-hmm. How did the other cards do?
Okay, well, taking a step back, the first Crockett Cup, they had talent from all over the place. They had Martel and Bravo from Montreal. They had guys coming in from Portland. They had a bunch of guys coming in from the UWF. The Sheep Herders, the Fantastics, DiBiase and Doc, I think.
I think Memphis have a crew in there? Wasn't Dundee or somebody in there?
I don't think so, but I could be wrong. This is right after they had that problem with Memphis,
late
85.
Right.
Yep. So they had a bunch of promotions represented. I mean, they had Tiger Mask and Baba over from Japan. So, okay, it's a giant tournament. And I think the first one lasted 2 days. I think it was Saturday afternoon, then Saturday night.
This was a mistake, but it was afternoon and it was night, and you had a main event for each. I think the first one was like the UWF title. It was Slater and
Duggan,
and then the main on the evening card was Rhodes and Flair, of course.
Yep, that is correct. And, you know, so that one having a 24-team tournament or whatever it was, it made sense. Now, look at how much the world has changed in 1987. Jim Crockett is walking alone, and he's doing it on his own, yet for some reason, he does not reformat the Crockett Cup so that, I mean, wouldn't it make sense to have 8 teams? And then if you really need to have Ric Flair against somebody else, or Ric Flair against a top contender as your main event.
Yeah, and you just need 2 or 3 teams who are, they all don't have to be from everywhere. I mean, you can just have, like, say, bring in a team from Japan, you know, bring in like maybe the Sheep Herders or something like that, and then have the rest of your best teams.
Yeah, and the Sheep Herders were theirs anyway, but here's what I think you want. Teams like, you know, they were having jobbers in the tournament, and there's no reason why you couldn't have had a one night show, not two segments, but one show at night with 8 top tag teams where you look at them and each of them has a reasonable shot of winning, as opposed to just, you know, having nothing but squash matches your first round or two.
I just pulled up 87, JCP, some of the people involved here. You have Bill Dundee actually here with the Barbarian. You have Denny Brown and Chris Champion. Mm-hmm. You have Mike Graham and Nelson Royal. Tim Horner's here. Ricky Lee Jones. And the Italian Stallion. Good Lord. Rocky King, Tejo Khan. Is it fair to say that Tejo Khan may be the worst wrestler ever on a major promotion?
Oh, I mean, I can name Mighty Joe Thunder is always going to be number one to me.
True.
And here's my big question: when Ricky Lee Jones is there, did he come to the ring to Chucky's in Love?
Who is Lasertron?
Yeah, Hector Guerrero with the dumbest one of the dumbest gimmicks ever.
Who are the Thunderfoots 1 and 2?
They were two jobbers. I think it was Joel Deaton and someone else. And no offense to Joel, I'm calling him a jobber. He was a really talented guy. But they were out there with these, like, very silly, like, spandex outfits. And their gimmick, which they never used, was the loaded boot gimmick. But they were just a jobber tag team.
And then the Russian team, which must have taken a great deal of thought coming up with that name. Yes, we're the Russian team. Ivan Koloff and some bald guy they picked up from the concession stand.
Pietrov was a student of the guy in Minnesota who trained like the Road Warriors and everyone else.
Oh, that makes you feel better. Okay, so now we head into 88, and I'm assuming this list is not getting better.
The list gets worse, the way worse.
We have the okay. Thank you, the Italian Stallion decided to get a new tag team partner, Kendall Windham. That's an upgrade. Rocky King and Nelson Royal. Basically, we just shuffled everyone around from the last one.
Rocky King was the guy whose name I couldn't come up with, but I think he had been on TBS for at least 5 years and never won a match. But let's put him in this tournament.
The Green Machine and the Terminator, who probably Italian Stallion and Kendall Windham in masks.
Green Machine was Bugsy McGraw in a mask. Better yet. Better yet.
Yes. And who was the Terminator, do you know?
Mac and Jim Jeffers. No, wait a minute. I'm wrong. One of them was Road Warrior Animal's brothers. So it was like two guys with like Terminator haircuts.
Oh, who's John Savage?
Like he was a TV job guy. They put him in there?
With Johnny Ace. And then the Twin Devils, who is one of them is Firebreaker Chip, I remember that. And I have no idea who the other guy is.
Okay, and they were not the Twin Devils, like the guys who were twins who wrestled in like Houston and Los Angeles in the late 70s.
I hope not.
No, they weren't.
So lead me up to this. What problems do we have going into the Crockett Cup this year in 1988?
Well, I mean, the biggest problem you have is if your promotion is a boat, it has taken a lot of water at this point. I think that the Crockett Cup concept, after 3 years, we were talking about the Survivor Series. You know, after a while, it gets a little bit old and beaten down, and we're there with the Crockett Cup. I think the Crockett Cup now has become a bit mythologized. Like, oh, it was such a big deal back then. Like, the 86 one looked great, but, you know, 87, put it this way, I didn't even consider making the trip from Nashua to Baltimore, which I had done, and I would will still have done multiple times.
Here is your first round in 1988. You have Johnny Ace and John Savage against Brad Armstrong and Tim Horner. And that's probably the best match of the bunch. Next, you have the Cruel Connection. Who? I have no idea
connection.
Who the Cruel Connection 1 and 2 against the Sheepherders. I'm assuming that wasn't long. You have Ivan and Dick Murdoch, that's pretty cool, against Mighty Wilbur and Jimmy Valiant.
That is a quality tag team.
Just the name alone tells me he can't be a good wrestler. You can't be a good wrestler named Mighty Wilbur. You have Chris Champion and Mark Starr against the Twin Devils, and you have Rocky King and Nelson Royal against Tiger Conway Jr. How old is Tiger Conway Jr. at this point?
I don't think he's that old. He's probably like mid to late 30s.
Tiger had matches against Johnny Valentine.
Was that junior?
Yeah, I think
even
so.
Even then, I mean, Johnny Valentine, you know, 15 years ago, he hadn't had the playing wreck yet.
So he seemed older. But and then the last match, the Green Machine and the Terminator, and this was my theory, because they were against the Italian Stallion and Kendall Windham.
That is well worth spending your afternoon indoors watching wrestling. Mighty Wilbur used to get tapes for me.
Which tapes, may I ask?
Tapes of himself. He didn't have a lot of footage of his career, and he was the bitterest guy in the world. He hated the wrestling business. He hated everyone associated with it. They all treated him badly. They played ribs on him. Oh, no. But, yeah, I got to know him a little bit maybe 15, 20 years ago, more like 20.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed one match. Al Perez and Larry Zbyszko against Joe Cruz and Ricky Santana.
Now, you see right there, if you're promoting this, do you not see what you are promoting?
And, I mean, it's okay, you have 1, 2, 3 random buys for no reason. It's just bizarre. Why does this have to – this is like the old AWA. What was that tournament they had at the end where nobody had any idea what the score was?
The Championship Challenge Series.
Yeah, it's just like that. And all of a sudden, like, two teams end up in the final somehow. One of those double elimination things. So how did Bill Apter nearly screw everything up?
Okay, this is something I emailed to Sean. Bill Apter, and I will put. Oh, this will actually. I'll use the photo as the show photo. They had now. Here's what they did. Crockett Cup '88. The original teams, two of them, were Barry Windham and Lex Luger, who were the NWA Tag Team Champions when they put out the seedings, I think. But anyway, a few weeks earlier, they were NWA Tag Team Champions. Also, another team is Sting, who is, you know, quickly and unexpectedly became a star, teaming with former NWA Champion Ronnie Garvin. And right before the tournament, I think it was the Saturday before the tournament, they did the taping where Barry Windham turned heel on Lex Luger. And, of course, Dusty Rhodes as the Midnight Rider got in on it. But it was, I think that was one of the greatest turns of all time, by the way. The picture at the end of Barry Windham in the limo with one hand holding the Midnight Rider mask and with the other hand holding up the Four Horsemen sign. So yeah, it was the Saturday before, and I know it. You know, it didn't air because they. I remember reading in the Observer that Barry Windham had. They announced the Barry Windham turn at the arena, and the fans went nuts cheering for it. So yeah, I mean, you've got all kinds of problems in Crockett. But anyway, because of the turn, Lex Luger needed a partner, and Ronnie Garvin got injured at the tournament, so. As the tournament was going on, the Lex Luger and Sting tag team was put together. And wow, a team that wasn't even announced as a team came out winning the tournament. Now, that's a major surprise. And they had that planned out, I don't know for how long, but probably for a couple of months. And right before the tournament, Bill Apter came out, published one of his magazines. I think it was Wrestling 88. And they had Lex Luger and Sting posing with a trophy. And I think Apter called it like the Future Champions Trophy or something like that. But it looked just like the Crockett Cup. So about 2 weeks before the Crockett Cup comes to be, it was the Future World Champion Trophy. And it looks a little bit like the Crockett Cup, but I mean, here these two are on the cover of the magazine, each holding one side of a trophy. And apparently when this got to the NWA offices, everyone got a little bit flipped out because Apter had kind of spilled the beans. And I remember someone calling me about this. They're like, hey, did you see the cover of this Apter magazine? And I had it, but I hadn't thought about it. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute, this can't be an accident.
Okay, now, here's my problem with this, is that, Bill Apter, so I'm looking at the most recent issue of Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and right now it looks like Ted DiBiase is terrorizing the NWA. My implication is that there is a bit of a gap between the actual event and when the magazine comes out.
Oh, yeah, the Apter mags were notorious for running late. I mean, they would have, I would say by the time you got them, the news in the Apter mag was 6 to 8 weeks old.
Right. And they still had a problem with this.
They did, because for whatever reason, I remember this specifically, the magazine had hit the newsstands before the actual tournament. So however it happened, it happened. And the NWA, and here's the thing, the NWA, you know, Dusty and Crockett had kind of partnered with the Apter magazines. Dusty would give Apter all kinds of access. He actually had a talk segment on WTBS for a while.
Apter would show up on TV all the time with the various awards, but he had to do this because Vince threw him out.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, that's true. I mean, in theory, a magazine is going to be objective, but of course, you know, the Apter magazines were not objective towards the WWF. They became a
obvious bit
of a house organ for Dusty and JCP.
No, it was like, I didn't know any of this at this point. We're talking like I was probably 8, 9, 10 years old. And even I knew, you know, it was obvious that there was something with the WWF.
I knew in 1983, and forgive me if I discussed this on the show before. I don't think I have, But summer, I want to say, spring of 1983, as usual, I went out and I bought my copy of The Wrestler and Inside Wrestling. I opened up and the WWF champion, or excuse me, just the AWA and NWA champions were listed as world champions. The WWF was no longer a world champion. And I was like, okay, that's just complete garbage. And I knew it, that, you know, somehow the AWA title is more prestigious than the WWF. And I knew, and again, the tone of their coverage toward the WWF changed as well. So I could sense, even though I was like, what, 17, that something went on between the WWF and the After magazines. And
this was definitely
before the you know, before the war totally broke out.
You're clearly trashing the AWA title. I mean, they defended in the upper Midwest and Memphis and Houston. That's a world title for you right there. Now, okay, it's pretty bad when you're so off your game that your house organ nearly scoops you when they their news is 3 months old. Nice job.
I mean, it's true. And the thing is, you know, obviously they wanted to keep the winners of the Crockett Cup a secret, and they wanted you to be surprised when a team that wasn't even a team coming in, Sting and Lex Luger, won this thing.
So we're winding down here, so toward the end. So it's probably best for you to, you probably know about this, but what were the last days like? What was going on? Was it a surprise? Was it?
It was not a surprise. I think starting like the beginning of 1988, the rumors started that, you know, Crockett could no longer keep this company solvent. And they got stronger and stronger as the year went on. And I know by summer of 1988, they were just polishing off the details. That, you know, I think Jim Crockett was trying to hang on, but it was kind of, you know, it was kind of the only thing people were talking about. Like, you know, wow, has this company been sold to WTBS yet? And finally, I want to say November 10th of 1988, it became official.
What were the changes?
It was a complete overhaul. You know, not a lot of people, and for good reason, a lot of people did not like Jim Herd. But Jim Herd actually had a really good idea that they never pulled the trigger on. But he said, you know, when we bought the company in 1988, he wanted to kind of be like a restaurant who puts up a sign that says closed for renovations. And his suggestion was that they run nothing but old matches on TV, I don't know, for until, let's say, the beginning of 1989. They would get their house in order, and they would be, and then they would do a reboot, so to speak. Yeah, not so to speak, it would be a reboot. And, you know, because the wrestling business only knew one way how to operate, everyone kind of, no, Jim, that's a really terrible idea, even though it was a good idea. And
that's not just the wrestling. That's not just the wrestling business. That's the TV business. Anybody would have said no to that. I agree with you. It may not have been the worst idea in the world, but there's no way you're selling that one to anybody in the TV business. Two, that is going to be way any length of time it would take them to reboot is going to be too long. But again, you're right. It wasn't the worst idea in the world to create.
And they would have. On the bottom of the screen, one of his ideas was, you know, okay, we are – they would have like a clock running to the countdown. Like, okay, you know, 24 days until the new WC – or the new NWA comes on TV. I mean, you're right. Maybe for TV reasons they couldn't do it. But, I mean, you know what? If they had put on a bunch of old classic matches as opposed to the stuff they were actually putting on, it might have been more entertaining.
WWF tried that. That didn't fly either.
No, they didn't. I enjoyed it. They did it on TBS at the beginning of 1985 on the Sunday show.
I enjoyed it too, because there were matches. Kenny Patera, and there were other matches I didn't see. That was just painful. But I mean, after this, the business kind of went down a little bit.
Oh, the business had gone way down.
But I mean, it's gonna get worse.
You would watch their television, like NWA Worldwide, like fall of 1988, and the arena would be completely darkened because you would have like 500 people there. I went to a show at the Philadelphia Civic Center February of 1989, and there was like, I want to say 1,200 people there for, it was Sting and Eddie Gilbert against Ric Flair and Barry Windham. It was a pretty solid card. It wasn't great, but the place was empty.
And I mean, how was WWF doing at this time?
They were doing great. They were coming. I mean, they had cooled off
in 89, like 88, 89.
88 was good. 89, you started to see like the cracks in the armor, like Hulkamania was getting old. Not having Hogan around a lot of 88 probably hurt them a little bit, but they were still doing good business until, let me see, when it became 1990, it was like, you know, a little bit at a time, attendance was going down, and then 92, they like just fell off a cliff.
By 88 and 89, Hogan became a problem for them because, I mean, it's, you know, it's easy to sit there and look and go, oh, but you couldn't elevate anybody. Do you remember the story that Jerry Jarrett did when he tried to get over Jimmy Valiant? He got Lawler out of town for a little bit
because mm-hmm.
he said you can't get over two guys at the same time. Whenever Hogan's there, you basically have to wait till he, you know, he just goes away, because either that or you have to have the guts to do something about it. He really was kind of a, I mean, he still drew, but I mean, you couldn't elevate anybody else.
No.
So when he did leave, there was nobody there.
You know, and you're right. He was gone for a while. They did two things when they tried to, I don't know if replace Hulk Hogan is the word. I mean, they wanted to have two house shows a night, so you needed two main event baby faces. With Savage, they pushed Savage hard, like late 87 throughout 88 until the turn in 89. But Savage was always clearly Robin to Hulk Hogan's Batman.
Yep.
Then they did Ultimate Warrior in 1990, and they tried to make Warrior like the number one baby face, but Hogan was the number one A baby face.
Yeah, Hogan was real cutie about that one too, wasn't he? He sat there and he put the guy over and he got real slick and he put himself over right afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I think what they did with Hogan, you know, calling him, and, you know, Warrior was the champion, but Hogan was, I forget what they were calling him, like the Legends Legend or something like that, and it just undercut Warrior. But anyway, wow, an hour goes by fast every week, does it not? So I want to thank everyone for listening, and this has been a product of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We'll see you next week.